Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live on the Land of Israel Network, from the Land of Israel to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. We got a great show for you today. We're going to have the Christian Zionist, who is the godfather of the IDF. That's an incredible story, and how his remains came back 67 years after he passed away to the Land of Israel, and the lawyer who helped make that happen. And in his footsteps, of her help, of bringing him back to the land, she came back with her family as well. That's going to be an incredible story of John Henry Patterson. That's coming up next. And after that, Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer, getting ready to deal with Passover, with the Passover liberation of our minds and souls, not only from the slavery of Egypt, but the slaveries that we put upon ourselves, the limitations of our own consciousness, the limitations of the belief systems that we have about ourselves. We're going to get stronger and better through this Passover, and we're going to pass it from one generation to the next with the incredible advent of this commandment and this narrative and informational chip called matzah, the magic of matzah, coming up next. So let's get the show into high gear. Let's buckle in. Let's get ready to listen to amazing stories from the Land of Israel here on the landofisrael.com network and the Yishai Fleisher Show. Here we go. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show here on the landofisrael.com, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Folks, I'm in the Mamilla Mall at a beautiful cafe with a window on Jerusalem, and it is a glorious gray and rainy day out there in Jerusalem. Maybe the last rains of the winter. The next bit of weather that's going to be coming is just sunny and hot and 80 degrees, and Passover is coming. Passover is in the air right now. But right now, God has given this land, once again, some of his blessings, the blessings of rain. And inside the cafe, I'm having some coffee, but you know what? It's raining here a little bit as well, because as I'm having my coffee, I'm looking at my computer screen, and I'm reading a story of an incredible hero. The hero's name is Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson of the British Army, an Irishman, a Christian Zionist, and actually known for something in the Jewish world, known for one thing, which is really being the godfather of the Israeli army. And out there in the world, three movies have been made about him, nothing to do with Zionism and nothing to do with being the godfather of the Israeli army. And the reason there's some tears here inside is because, not sad tears, but kind of happy tears, because this man, who was not only a hero in how he led Jews into battle, he helped Jews form into the first fighting force that the Jewish people have had in 2,000 years. Not only that, but he stood up against anti-Semitism in the ranks of the British military. His whole career was hurt by that, but he stood proudly with the belief that the Jewish people needed to come home and needed to be empowered to come home and have their own strength back. Not just be under some mandatory rule, but really be strong again. And it takes sometimes people from the outside, sometimes non-Jews, to tell the Jewish people, hey, you can be strong again, and let me give you some of my experience. My experience as a fighting soldier, my experience from around the world, to help you get back to what you once were a long time ago. And the story that we're going to talk today is about this incredible man, but also about his final wishes. He himself passed away in Los Angeles and wanted, he had said and he had written, I want to be buried with my men in the Land of Israel. That's what at least I understood was his final wishes. But it was only about 2 years ago that his wishes were actually completed. And I found a very beautiful article in the Times of Israel, which is all about a British colonel who finally had his wish granted, burial in Israel near the soldiers that he led. And as I was reading this and studying the people who were involved in making this reburial happen here in the Land of Israel, I also got to know a civil litigator from Los Angeles, now living here in the Land of Israel. Her name is Myrna Strapp. And the article goes on to say that while other lawyers didn't want to get involved with the hassle of getting the remains of Colonel Patterson to the land of Israel, there was a lawyer in Los Angeles who was willing to take the case and to make a stink out of it, to make a federal case out of it, and to start the process of bringing those remains of Colonel Patterson to the land of Israel. Myrna, thank you so much for joining me here at Cafe Greg in the land of Israel.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, Myrna, you get a phone call one day, or what happens that somebody that you get involved in the case of bringing the remains of a British colonel buried in Los Angeles to the land of Israel?
Well, I was sitting in my law office one day, got a call from a woman who we had befriended over the years by the name of Doris Wise. She heads an organization by the name of Children of Jewish Holocaust Survivors. She called me and said, "Myrna, do you know who John Henry Patterson is?" And I thought I did, and I was confusing him with Colonel Peters from Fox News. When she corrected me, I actually did remember his name, as I had been familiar with the biography Lone Wolf on Jabotinsky, whom references Patterson several times. She tried to explain to me why she was calling and was kind of confused, and she said, "Listen, call this fella. His name is Jerry Klinger. He is president of the Jewish American Society for Historic Preservation. He'll tell you what he needs." She said, "I've contacted several other litigators. They're not interested in helping, and see what you can do." I called Jerry. He explained what the problem was and asked for my help. And I still remember my exact words to him: "It would be a privilege and an honor to have some connection to people we consider heroes and help to bring Patterson to Israel."
So other litigators didn't want to deal with it. Why not?
I don't know if it was...
There's probably no money in it.
Correct. It is an obscure area of the law. There are not that many cases calling for reinterment, and possibly Doris hadn't found the right attorneys, or possibly they didn't have the heartfelt wishes about the case.
So what happened was is that Colonel Patterson finished off his career in the British Army. As I read on Wikipedia, he basically didn't have, he could have gone further in the British Army, but his strong stance against anti-Semitism and his recurring threats to quit the army if this anti-Semitism would stand, it really stopped him from moving a lot forward in the British Army. And he ended up somehow retiring in Los Angeles. How did that happen? Do you know?
Well, my understanding is that at some point, Jabotinsky asked him as a non-Jew if he would go to America in support of the Jewish state. Jabotinsky felt that Patterson would have access to the corridors of power in ways that a Jew did not at that period of time. When he got to America, he befriended our present Prime Minister's father, Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as Peter Bergson. And they worked closely together on behalf of the formation of a state. And as you can imagine, the British government didn't take kindly to that. So... I don't know what the excuse was, but they cut off his pension. Wow. He was without funds to live, and a benefactor in California, actually in Bel Air, permitted him and his wife to live on her estate in the, I don't know if it was the carriage house, the guest house, but that is where he ended his days.
Wow. Now, let me go back a little bit. What are we talking about? We're talking about a man who... His actions that we're talking about, helping the Jews establish basically two aspects of a Jewish fighting force. First, the Zion Mule Corps, and then the actual Jewish Legion. This is in the dawn of World War I, Okay, as the Jewish people, Zionism is kind of gathering steam. There's that kind of consciousness. There's people like Jabotinsky calling for Jewish strength to return as part of Zionism. You know, Zionism was about farming. It was about communism for some people. It was about Hebrew. But the idea of Jewish strength was a kind of new one. And Jabotinsky was one of the leaders of that thinking. And he befriends this John Henry Patterson, who's what? He's a Christian Zionist, a man who's classically raised on the Bible, an Irishman. Irish people, there's a deep-rooted anti-Semitism, and yet at the same time, those Bible-loving folks in that part of the world, there was restitutionism, reconstitution of the Jewish people became a belief that was at the same time as Zionism. And John Henry Patterson was one of those people. He really believed that the Jewish people would be reconstituted, restored. Restorationism was the term to the land of Israel, and he gives his knowledge and his leadership within the British Army to create this Jewish fighting force. But before we go on, Myrna, I want to talk about for 1 second about what the rest of the world knows John Henry Patterson for. You know, there's been 3 movies made about his life. One called Bwana Devil, another one called Killers of Kilimanjaro, and the third one is called The Ghost of the Darkness, which he was portrayed by Val Kilmer, a well-known actor. And the story basically is that he's out there in Africa trying to build a Uganda railway and a bridge over the Tsavo River. And basically what happens is that there were 2 man-eating lions who were dragging men out of their tents in a very unusual fashion. And it's been reported that some 140 people, including the villagers there, were eaten by these man-eating lions. And this was a scourge. Nobody understood it. There was an issue of, you know, maybe it's some kind of curse. Maybe the devil has taken these lions. Maybe we should not build this bridge. And John Henry Patterson not only commanded the building of this bridge, but also himself being a tiger hunter and a lion hunter, faced these 2 lions and shot them dead, and almost got killed doing it in the process when one of the wounded lions charged at him. These were giant lions, and this was such a famous story, and so much fear. It spread throughout the world about these man-eating lions, the story, and he became the hero. So that's what he's famous for in the world. But you know, it reminds me a little bit of King David. King David says, you know, he says to his brothers when about to face Goliath, he says, listen, I faced the bear and the lion. You know, I've fought them myself. I can face Goliath. So too, John Henry Patterson, who faced these lions later on in his life, faces the lion of anti-Semitism and of the line of the great challenge of helping the Jewish people reconstitute a Jewish presence in the land of Israel and return back to pre-exilic strength, to the fighting tradition of the Jewish people. So that's actually the background of this man. And now we're sitting with Myrna Strapp, the lawyer who helped bring his remains back to the land of Israel. Myrna, let's talk a little bit about John Henry Patterson in terms of his actual work with Jabotinsky, in terms of the establishment of these 2 fighting forces. What can you tell us?
Well, my understanding is that when the British finally acceded to Jabotinsky's petition to form a fighting force on behalf of the Jews to throw the Ottoman out of control in what was then Palestine, the British told Jabotinsky that he could not lead, or a Jew would not lead that force, but they selected Patterson as the leader to constitute the Zion Mule Corps.
So they fought out there in Gallipoli, and they were a mule corps. They were bringing stuff in transport through mules, but they actually fought. They engaged in battle. And Patterson writes about the Jews. He says, I thought that they were kind of cowardly at first, but it turns out that they were very brave under fire.
It's a wonderful transformation that he sees from what he conceived that he thought he would find and what he actually found in the Zion Mule Corps. So much so that his grandson said that of all the things in his career. And he, as you've mentioned, he had a quite varied and exciting career. The thing that meant the most to him was fighting alongside the soldiers in the Zion Mule Corps.
This came from his belief in the Bible?
I think so.
Came from a very deep-rooted belief in also this concept of restorationism, which was that this is really coming to fruition, and that the British at the time, certainly in that era, were going to help the Jewish people fulfill that dream, which is to return to the land of Israel. Now he goes on from the Zion Mule Corps, which was kind of the earlier version, takes a lot of those folks and constitutes the Jewish Legion, which is going to be another part of the British fighting force, which is actually going to fight in Palestine. There's going to be 1,000 troops that are part of this thing.
It's quite amazing. From a colonel, from an idea that there needed to be a Jewish fighting force for Palestine, to what he eventually led. And from what I understand, it's a testament not only to the men who fought for him, but his leadership.
So in June of 1918, the volunteers of this 38th Battalion, which is the Jewish Legion, began engaging the Ottomans. So they actually fought the Ottoman Turks some 20 miles north of Jerusalem. In the fighting in the Jordan Valley, more than 20 legionnaires were killed, wounded, and captured. And the rest came down with malaria. That was another scourge back then. And 30 of this group later died. The Legion came under the command of, later on, somebody named Edward Chater. But besides various skirmishes, the Legion participated in the Battle of Megiddo, in 1918, widely considered to have been one of the final and decisive victories on the Ottoman front. The Legion's mission was to cross the Jordan River and basically to take over also what would later become Jordan. But what we see here is that the Jewish people who were part of this were actually, they really had a chance for the first time in 2,000 years to be liberators of their own land. In fact, one of the battalions was called the First Judeans, and it had a distinctive cap badge, a menorah, with the Hebrew words Kadima, forward. That goes to show you how forward, indeed, this thinking was. Okay, so Patterson is involved in this. He helps get that idea into the British Army. And then we talked about his retirement. But let's talk a little bit about his death and the last stage, which you've been involved in.
Well, unfortunately, he died 6 months before the founding of the State of Israel,
wow.
Which it's such a pity. And his wife passed away 6 weeks later. Both of them were cremated, and their remains were interred in the Los Angeles, or the Angeles Rosedale Cemetery, which is in downtown LA. And there he remained for 67 years until I got the call asking if I could help have him and his wife have their remains taken to Israel.
Now, what awoke in the other parties the issue of taking care of this now? What happened?
Well, Jerry Klinger, who is a colorful and interesting fellow with a wonderful organization, happened to read a biography about Patterson. And in the biography, in the back of the biography, there was an afterword by Patterson's sole surviving heir, grandson, Alan Patterson. In that afterword, Alan Patterson said, "I believe, as explained by my father, that my grandfather's wish was to be laid to rest next to the soldiers he led in the Zion Mule Corps and the Jewish Corps."
So it wasn't recorded anywhere else, but he, Alan, believed that he heard that maybe, and he had written that.
That's correct.
And then who read it?
Jerry Klinger, Jewish American Society for Historic Preservation.
So Jerry's reading at his bed. He's about to turn off the light. He suddenly reads this phrase and he thinks to himself, gosh,
I can do something about this. I can fulfill his dream.
Okay.
And he started on a journey. I was not involved at that point. He got, he did a remarkable amount of groundwork. He got the Ministry of Religion. He got Beit Avichai Avigal and Hagadudim, which is the museum in the Moshav where the men who fought, who formed the Zion Mule Corps, who fought, settled and made this Moshav and museum. He got
a memorial for these for these original Jewish fighting force. Now again, this is pre-state. This is before there was an IDF. This is the original kernels of the IDF. So there's a Moshav in the north that they remember that foundational those foundational efforts. And there's a museum on premises there.
Correct. He got them on board. He got the Religious Affairs Ministry on board. The Prime Minister's office was on board, very excited, because John Henry Patterson was very close to the Prime Minister's father. And in fact, when Yonatan Netanyahu, Bibi's older brother who fought and fell at Entebbe, was born, John Henry Patterson was his godfather and presented the family with a chalice, which the Prime Minister has to this day.
And it is also rumored and said, and later on was said, that Yoni Netanyahu may have been, and that means Jonathan Netanyahu, may have been named after John Henry Patterson.
Well, the Prime Minister said that he was named after Colonel Patterson as well as Ben-Zion's grandfather. Mm-hmm. So I think it's true.
So the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, he's the son of Ben-Zion Netanyahu, who is Jabotinsky's number one secretary and a great historian. Passed away just a few years ago. The Prime Minister himself understands, the Prime Minister of the State of Israel understands the importance, the historical significance of this, and wants to, as in his words, repay a debt.
That's correct.
He gets behind this. Now, in Israel, I don't know how it is in other countries, in Israel, when the Prime Minister's office is behind something,
it helps.
It helps. It helps a lot. That's how things start to move in this country.
And so Jerry Klinger got all of the necessary groups on board. He then called the Los Angeles Rosedale Cemetery, explained what he was doing. They said, fine. He comes back a year later after everything is really in order, calls the cemetery, and they said, oh, I'm so sorry. I know someone told you it was fine, but you can't get the remains without a court order.
Sure, and that makes sense. Can't be coming around digging up people's remains willy-nilly. There must be some legal grounds for it. You have to prove it to a court. That makes a lot of sense. You can't just come into a cemetery and dig up remains. So that's when you've got to step in here.
That's when I come into the picture. And Jerry explained to me what he needed, and I remember full well telling him it would be a privilege and an honor to do it. Although I was not an expert in this area of the law, I was going to do my best. And I did. And it was a wonderful experience. I met, when I say met, I talked to, communicated with several very interesting people and got their declarations so we would have the appropriate papers to submit to the court. And about the time of the Gaza War, I think it was Operation Protective Shield, I went to court, and the court granted the order.
Not at first, though.
Not at first. The first time I went to court, the judge was not convinced I had made a clear enough case based on the grandson's declaration that he was truly the only interested party in this situation. I understood what the judge was telling me. I went back to Allen. We reformulated the declaration, and I had it approved. It was July 2014.
Okay, so the court agrees. Great. The paperwork is in order. Now it's time to get the nitty-gritty here. And the nitty-gritty is to take remains out of the ground, out of where they're interred in Los Angeles, and move them over to Israel, and to do that with dignity. That itself is also not an easy step. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I made the call to Jerry and I said, we got the order. It was the middle of a war, and I knew for sure that this didn't take priority at that moment in time.
Sure.
There were soldiers on our battlefield for real. I'm not pretend, but actually dying. I waited, hopeful that something would happen sooner than later, as we had our Aliyah scheduled for December of that year, and I wanted to get over for whatever they were going to do before that time. A couple months later, I would say it was September. It was maybe October. After the war.
We're talking about the last Gaza war. We're talking about Protective Edge, Tzuketan, what we call in Hebrew, the Gaza skirmish fight war that happened, and certainly no other things could have happened at that time, and certainly the prime minister wouldn't be available to deal with this issue.
Right. So I got a call October, we're coming to get the remains. I called the Angela Cemetery, who I had developed a good relationship with, the woman who was in charge of the cemetery, a lovely woman, a really lovely woman. She was very excited. She called me back and she said, I have the box. Should I break the seal so I can put the ashes into a container for traveling? And I told her in no uncertain terms not to open the seal, and that we would come the next day. The Consul General's Office of Los Angeles.
Wait, just for clarity's sake, she had the what exactly?
Well, Colonel Patterson was cremated.
Okay.
What I came to know, which I hadn't known before, is when someone is cremated, their ashes are put into a box.
Okay.
Kind of, I would describe it, if you've ever seen a safety deposit box where you put important papers in a bank and it goes into a wall, a long narrow box. It looked like that, and it was sealed with a wax seal. And both the colonel and his wife were in that box.
Wow.
It's very interesting.
I didn't know that.
The Consul General's office sent two people from the LA office. The Israeli Consul General from the LA office. The Prime Minister's office sent a representative. And the Moshav had a representative. Jerry Klinger came, and I was there. I still get choked up.
That's okay.
It was a beautiful ceremony.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. They put up an Israeli flag. They put up an American flag. And they read Psalms, both in Hebrew and in English. And to see the respect that was paid to a man who was gone for 67 years and whose contribution to the state had preceded that by many years,
right,
was a very moving thing.
But that wasn't the end of it. There was another ceremony in the land of Israel.
That's correct. So they took the remains back to Israel, and I waited to hear when a ceremony would be scheduled. It was scheduled at the beginning of December of 2014. Unfortunately, my husband and I did not go because we made Aliyah on December 30. But our daughter was there representing us, and it was, from the clips I've seen and what I was told, it was a beautiful ceremony. A military band played, the Prime Minister spoke, Alan Patterson, the grandson, spoke, and with a lot of dignity and decorum, Colonel Patterson and his wife were interred at the cemetery in Avichal, near the museum, Beit HaGadudim.
And the Prime Minister was there as well, and he spoke, saying that it was important to recognize the contributions of Colonel John Henry Patterson. And I have a few of the words here, and I think it'll be fun to read it a little bit. He says, and again, he has a very personal, the Prime Minister has a very personal, I wish I could interview him on this issue. Maybe I will. Patterson was a remarkable non-Jewish Zionist. A British officer, he commanded the first Jewish fighting units in centuries, the Zion Mule Corps, founded by Joseph Trumpeldor, which participated in the Gallipoli campaign. And he says, Patterson went on to command the Jewish Legion, founded by Zev Jabotinsky. Soldier and intellectual, he collaborated with my father, Bencion Netanyahu, in America at the outbreak of World War II, when my father came to the United States as a member of Jabotinsky's delegation to campaign for the establishment of a Jewish state. Such was the friendship between them that my parents decided to call their firstborn son, Jonathan, the John, in honor of Patterson, and the Nathan, Jonathan, the Nathan part, in honor of his grandfather. Now and then, on special occasions, my family brings out a silver cup with the inscription, "To my darling godson, Jonathan, from your godfather, John Henry Patterson." And of course, Yoni Netanyahu died in the fight for the state of Israel in the famous Entebbe operation. Myrna, this is beautiful stuff. This is a great story. It's the greatest story of a love affair with the Bible, with the Bible coming true, with fighting, making those that biblical ideal be real on the ground by fighting for the Jewish rights, by fighting against enemies who wanted to destroy Israel, by fighting against anti-Semitism within the British Army itself, and also the great memory of the Jewish people, the ability to have a memory. The very fact that you and I feel emotional about discussing this right now is a testament to the Jewish people's great memory. And another testament to that, I want to finish off with this, is the fact that you've alluded here a few times that you yourself have made Aliyah. You and your husband, successful attorneys in Los Angeles, in America. You sound to me like you have a bit of a Southern accent, maybe. You know, somehow you've made it home. Tell me a little bit about where you're from, where your family is from, and why you've come home here to the land of Israel now.
You know, when you said come home to Israel, it brings tears to my eyes because we truly feel that, and we feel the privilege, the gift every day. I'm from Pittsburgh. I've been accused of having a Southern accent, but it's really just Pittsburgh. My husband and I started on this journey, I guess, when we were married 47 years ago, but more specifically when we first came to Israel with our rabbi in Columbus, Ohio, of blessed memory, David Stavsky. We fell in love with the state and knew in some way we would always be connected. My husband was ready to come before I was. I was a slow learner. But at some point we knew that we were coming, and thank God it took a while, but we've been here for about 15 and a half months, and we've appreciated and enjoyed every day.
All right, so you're brand new in the land. And who knows, maybe it was also the fact that you gave assistance to a man who yearned for the land of Israel, but who was buried. That's there's no greater example of the Jewish people's rebirth than the chapters in Ezekiel chapter 36 and 37 that talk about being taken out of your graves and coming to the land of Israel. That's what you did for John Henry Patterson, Lieutenant Colonel, who helped the Jewish people become strong again. You helped him come out of his grave and come to the land of Israel. So maybe his spirit, as he helped Jews of the past, he pulled you out of the diaspora as well and brought you here to the land of Israel. Myrna Strapp, you are a civil litigator here in the land of Israel now, formerly of California. You've done a lot for the Jewish people. I want to thank you so much for this fantastic interview, and may the memory of Colonel John Henry Patterson be a blessing for all of us.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Myrna Strapp. I know that I did, because I thought it was an incredible opportunity to kind of rehash history and give this incredible hero, John Henry Patterson, another shot at inspiring us to continue to be brave Jews in the land of Israel, to believe in the Bible. And I know that he inspired Myrna, and I think he inspires all of us right now. And I'm glad that he's back in the land of Israel, continuing to lead his troops to courage and to fight for the right of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. I want to do a few shout outs right now. I want to shout out to my good friend Andy, who's somewhere right now in Atlanta, Georgia, coming home for the Passover holiday. God bless you, Andy, and thank you so much for the good work and that you and your family do. Thank you so much for all of your help. And I also want to say hi to my good friend Eric, who's somewhere in Europe right now, either Poland or Switzerland, but he's always on the way to Jerusalem, and he's a great fan and a great friend and a great critic as well. I appreciate you so much, Eric. I appreciate both of you guys. Please, folks, write me an email. It makes my day when you write me an email. My email is so easy, Yishai, Y-I-S-H-A-I, at thelandofisrael.com. Don't want to be pompous, but that is a great email address just to be able to write to you from where we are at, which is thelandofisrael.com. I also, speaking of the land of Israel, I want to talk about for a second the Jewish community that I work for. My day job is the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron. Hebron is the first capital of Israel, and the place of burial of the founding fathers and mothers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah. Please come and visit us and strengthen us as well and be strengthened. Check out our website, Hebron.com, and it'll lead you to our English site. Great stuff, and tours are available. Opportunities for really connecting to the source of the Bible is there for you. So don't delay another second. Connect to the mothers and fathers of the whole story, God's beloved. All right, folks. So we talked about bringing the remains out of the exile into the land of Israel. Now let's talk about from exile to Exodus. How do we get from the Egyptian bondage to through this night of Passover to liberation and freedom? How do we do that? We're going to do that by breaking the bonds that keep us small in our own heads, that keep us locked into much less than our potential and keep us away from ourselves and, of course, from God as well. How are we going to do that? With our great teacher, Rabbi Mike Foyer, who joins us every week on Spiritual Cafe. So let's do it. Let's Spiritual Cafe at a cafe in Jerusalem, in the land of Israel, on the landofisraelnetwork.com. Stay tuned, because here we go. Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. I am at beautiful Cafe Greg, the Greg Cafe, at the Bamilla Mall, and it is a beautiful, overcast, gray, dreary day here in Jerusalem, and we love it because it signals that the blessed rain is still coming down upon our land. And not only that, this rain, as I'm looking at drip, drip on Jerusalem, could very well be the last rains of the winter season. And so we've enjoyed this winter very much, but spring is coming, and that's signaled, of course, by the holiday of Pesach, Passover, which is coming, and you can feel it in the air here. And the feeling is not exactly a good feeling. The feeling before Passover is always one of mad, crazed, scared, nervous, lots to do, and most of my friends, and even just the atmosphere in Jerusalem, is a bit frayed, a bit nerved, a bit edged, and that's because the holiday of Passover, classically, is the holiday of liberation, but before liberation, you have to ascend into slavery, of cleaning, of preparing for Passover, and it is the holiday of preparation, if there was one. If Sukkot is a holiday of joy, and you build your huts, that's great. Here, it's like, you best not have one piece of chametz. Sukkot, worst comes to your worst, you can use your friend's hut, sukkah, booth. And Pesach, if you got one piece of chametz, you're in deep trouble. And so that's the atmosphere here. At the same time, we are drinking lattes here at Cafe Greg. By the way, I do want to remind you folks that you are listening to the Land of Israel Network. And also, I am the international spokesman of the Jewish community of Hebron, where the fathers and mothers are interred. And where our father Abraham, who is really the first person to keep the Passover, and Passover was a monumentous day in his life, is waiting for you to visit him over the Pesach holiday, in which there's going to be tens of thousands of people who are going to be coming to Hebron. But I'm not here alone here at Cafe Greg. I'm with our beloved co-host for our spiritual cafe, Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
We finally got some quality coffee.
We got some quality coffee instead of the coffee at Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, our beloved yeshiva over there at Cafe Greg. It's just a tad better, maybe. But as you can even hear from my voice, I'm a little bit frayed. My mind is a little bit everywhere, and that's because we're getting ready for Pesach. It's an intense holiday coming up.
As you said, the process of liberation is always preceded by an extremely tense time of, slavery, avoda, service, making lists of lists.
Servitude?
The difference really lies in one's consciousness. It's very easy to slide into servitude. And the question of what one is serving in that moment is important. Are you serving your own ego? Are you serving your fear? Are you serving other people's expectations? But when I go piece by piece and basically touch everything I own, which is what really happens through the cleaning process and Pesach. You basically put your hand everywhere it can reach inside your possessions. And I try to keep in mind that what I'm doing is in service of and not in servitude to.
That's interesting. You get to touch all your stuff. I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, it's that's really
it
the primary.
Reminds me of Laban, who touches all of Jacob's possessions.
Well, he rifles through, right? But the difference is that the primary expression of freedom that comes with Pesach, as we find it in the matzah itself, is a return to simplicity. It's a return to sort of an equilibrium where everything is on that starting plane. In the same way that matzah, of course, has no leaven, so it doesn't rise. It's flat. You know, it's plain. It's simple. There's water and wheat, and that is it. Right? In the same way, going through and cleaning out. I mean, I rolled back my refrigerator today and found stuff behind there that no one needs to know.
There are many rabbits that live behind the fridge.
Yeah, but you know what the amazing thing is that it represents that commitment to putting out the hand as far as it can reach, mm-hmm. and to unearthing those things which are really keeping us in slavery. And if you can keep that in mind while you're doing the physical act of cleaning, it can really be quite liberating.
You know, Rabbi Mike, we have a lot of parts of our life, if it's our personalities, that have parts that we haven't touched or we haven't kind of gotten into. Our bodies oftentimes succumb to lethargy. And, not, you know, when you stretch, a lot of times you're touching those parts that have not been touched. There are parts of our potential that oftentimes are not actually reached, where we don't, our hand doesn't get out there. A part of our dreams that we don't dare look at because our dreams are sometimes bigger than what we think we can do. And we don't actually follow them or go there. So there's a lot of things in this world where we're like, I'm afraid to touch that thing. Are you saying that Pesach in some way is like a liberation from those limitations, those fears, those go to those places that you're afraid to touch?
Absolutely. And I think the source of the courage that underlies that aspect of Pesach is the fact that in many ways it represents a completely new creation. Right, our sages teach us that there's an argument whether the world was created in Tishrei in the fall months or in Pesach in the spring. And there's no reason to get into the depth of their argument, but the answer, of course, as is always true, is it's an argument, right? And therefore, there's a side of truth to both. And the great event of God reaching his hand into history and taking us as a people out of the deepest, lowest place, not based on our merits, not based on our behaviors, but based on a promise that he had made and an expectation that he had for the world, right? And literally taking us one people out of another in a way which had never been seen and never will again shows that the past does not define the future.
The past does not define the future, and yet there are people who would like to get rid of the past so that they can define the future differently than the way it was kind of envisaged in the past.
Well, those are the people who truly are afraid.
Let me just clarify what I'm talking about. I'll give one example. A kind of very famous person in today's modern Israeli political scene is Shimon Peres, who I have heard on many occasions has said that we are too trapped by history, that we need to kind of not worry so much about history, and therefore define our future differently than the past. But what he means is, don't worry about places like Judea and Samaria. Don't give me this talk about ancestral homeland. Don't tell me too much about Judaism and Jewish state. We don't have to be defined by the... And he even has, there's this little meme that he has. He says, you know, we used to be called the people of the book. Now we're the people of the Facebook. Much better. Okay, so there's some people who would like to kind of get rid of history. How do you balance that issue of being a historical people defined very much by our history and by the promises of history for our destiny, as opposed to also what you're talking about, which is a certain liberation out of an internal narrative that very much can limit you, a contract that you've made with yourself, oftentimes a bad contract that you've made with yourself or with the people around you or with your kind of personal life destiny that you need to break out of this Passover?
Well, Peres, in that respect, is the embodiment of the classical Zionist vision. Right? The Zionists were the ones who, in order to free up their energy and build a better future, which, as we sit here in Cafe Greg, it's worth noting that, you know, 100 years ago, that this was a rocky hillside.
let me just correct you a little bit. I recall being a rocky hillside.
It was 15, 20 years ago.
I remember this place.
This specific is,
This place being almost a no-go zone.
Yes.
You didn't want to go here to where the Mamilla Mall was. It was dilapidated. There were some broken buildings. And today it is one of the most thriving thoroughfares in Jerusalem.
So the energy that it took to make that happen was was a liberated energy. Liberated in that Western cultural sense. So I'm liberated from the past. I can do what I want. Don't tell me what to do. I mean, Zionists, in many ways, the Zionist movement was a movement of children that rebelled against their parents. And in that sense, they had to kill their past. However, I think that many of the problems we face as people, problems that you and I have spoken about so much, and problems of vision, what does it mean to true leadership, and what stepping into the greatness of our dreams, as you said, as opposed to being afraid to reaching as far as they go, is because we shrank ourselves in doing that. The past offers a sense of context and scope and momentum and greatness, which, when it doesn't define the future, but rather lends it its vision and energy, can free it beyond all bounds. I mean, this, by the way, to me, is what it means when we say that every person is obligated in every generation to see themselves as if they themselves are going out of Egypt, right? And you know, there's an argument in how it's said, to see yourself or to show yourself as having gone out, like lirot or laharot, which is why some of our brothers, you know, Tamani brothers and others, have this a tradition of actually dressing up and packing up their bags and walking around the Seder table, because it's not meant to be some symbolic reenactment. It's meant to be a turning, looking deep at the past and a turning on the hinge of the present toward the future. Now, this is the great wisdom. You ever read any Toynbee?
Sure.
Right? The great British historian, the end of the 19th century. Right?
Arnold Toynbee.
So his whole perspective on history is based on the study of the civilization. And his question was, when do civilizations die? Right? And his answer ought to give us pause. Because he says, you know, oftentimes a civilization, because of the wealth and energy and momentum, will keep growing even after he claims it's dead. Because you know when a civilization dies? When it ceases to worship its future and begins to worship its past. Right? That when they're no longer forward-looking and simply nostalgic. That's not to mean that one who worships the future, meaning who is forward-looking, doesn't learn from their past, doesn't have a deep relationship with it, but their primary vision is ahead. And that's what happened to us in exile.
Interestingly enough, Toynbee was not a big fan of Israel. He would call us as a people a petrified people.
Yeah, fossilized.
Fossilized people.
I don't know that really makes him not such a fan. It did. We don't fit his model.
Right.
And nobody likes that. But what's amazing is that we, in many ways, prove his model to be true. Because what did the Zionists do that allowed us to unpetrify, defossilize, or whatever? It's exactly what they did. They cut off the past and began to worship their pioneers. Now, we, in the next generation of Zionists, have to figure out how we tell the story of our past in a way that which engages its power and energy and vision and yet moves it toward the future.
So we talk a lot on the show, in our Spiritual Cafe corner of the Yishai Fleischer Show. We talk a lot with you about narrative of the past, vision for the future. And Passover is really, I would call it, a super narrative tool. And I live working in Hebron. I'm oftentimes, you know, looking at the building of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. And I tell people, this is a narrative driver. This thing is a narrative driver. This thing is so big and so strong and so historical. It tells my story. It itself doesn't talk, but it lets me talk and tell that story. And maybe one of the most powerful, we have many powerful narrative tools in Judaism, circumcision is a powerful narrative tool. Certainly the Sabbath, which is a priori called a witnessing, it is a narrative tool. But maybe the most physical, concrete narrative tool that there are so many stories of self-sacrifice about, which there's something about the following thing that I'm about to say. It's simplicity and it's power and it's crossing of all generations. Is kind of one of the most symbolic, central narrative drivers of the Jewish people, and that is the plain bread of matzah. Just matzah. Matzah. Flour and water in this process, less than 18 minutes, so it doesn't get... The matzah itself takes about a minute to actually bake, and it's a, you know, it's this flat bread. It's really kind of stale and boring and crackery, and yet it's... When you eat it and eat it properly, there is something that I can only describe as some kind of transfer of data, of historic data. It's a genetic informational disk that is passed down through generations. It reminds me of the old floppy disks.
Except it's not particularly floppy.
It's not so floppy, especially the Ashkenazi version. Maybe the Sephardi version is a little, the Yemenite version is a little floppier. But there's something about this thing and the baking of it. Let me give you just one example. My mom's grandmother under the Soviet Union would bake matzah. And my mom remembers that as being this strange thing that used to happen. There's something visual about it. And, you know, you can make a simple joke saying Jews, you know, love food. And that's true. And really most people's love food. But there's something different about matzah. First thing, it's not something you can love that much. I like matzah, happen to be. But you know, it's not some great gourmet moment.
Well, it's not meant to be.
Right.
I mean, matzah is called lechem oni, right? With which can be translated as one of two ways. The bread of poverty, which, as you're saying, it's not meant to be enjoyed. We don't even add salt to it when we bake it. Right, it's meant to represent the simplicity and the stripped down nature of another aspect of freedom. Is that, you know, like a famous woman once said, that freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Right,
right, and that sense of absolute simplicity and poverty.
Right,
bread, kemach, flour and water, and that's it. And
right,
heat. Right, that's one. But the other meaning of it is lechem she'onim alav harbe. That it's a bread that we answer upon, that we speak on, and that's exactly what you said.
Matzah
itself becomes a platform, a narrative driver. I very much like that term because the experience around it and the experience of eating it. You know, one of my favorite moments of the entire year is that, you know, there's a specific moment in which we fulfill the commandment, the mitzvah, to eat matzah. Right, in the it's part of the Seder. It's right at the beginning of the meal. Right, and there's a lot of intentionality that goes into it, especially like myself. I make the matzah that we use on that night. So it begins the process already tomorrow. And it's the only sanctified eating that is left to us from the Torah's perspective now that the temple no longer stands. You know that?
I never thought of it that
all
way.
All other sanctified eating was the sacrifices. This is it. This is all that's left. So in that moment, one of my favorite moments of the whole year is everything goes silent. You say the blessing over the bread and the blessing over the mitzvah. And then what?
Crunch, crunch, crunch.
Crunch, crunch, crunch on the table. And there's something so funny and so bizarre and so free and so intense about the fact that what we're doing is we're sitting here eating. That's what we're doing. And that is going to carry everything that came before it, everything comes after it. I have memories, like you said, from my family, from my grandparents. You start going back through the generations. My father remembers his grandfather. His mother remembers her grandmother. It's on and on and on and on.
And that's what it's supposed to be, right? That's the matzah thing. Matzah, that's what I'm trying to say. There's something about matzah which carries memory. It's very hard to describe it, but I really do feel that when you eat the matzah, you are somehow imbibing memories. You somehow get, I don't know, you plug into history. You become part of history. And there's something about this thing. It's, you know, and there's a mysticism involved, certainly.
You plug into the future as well, because the mitzvah is to tell your children.
Right.
Right.
Which is another way of saying passing on memory.
Absolutely. It's meaning I hold my own experience in that moment. I think of it in my own life, in my memories, and in telling the story of the past. And then I'm focused as the head of my own Seder. I'm focused on my children in order that they're at some moment in the Seder. What's the goal? What do I want more than anything else? That one of my children, or all of them preferably, should pop up at some point and say, wait a minute, why did you do that? That's the goal. That moment of wonder.
Well, the technique of the Seder is that the child should be engaged in the Exodus of Egypt through basically asking a question, and that's what you're referring to, which is the way that they're going to be involved is they're going to say themselves, wait, there's something off tonight, something different tonight, and I want to know about it, and I'm personally interested in it, and I'm also allowed to be intellectually curious in Judaism, and the parents are kind of teaching. I think the Seder night is not just about the transfer of the story of the exile, Exodus from Egypt, but also what's it like to be a Jew? And the way it's like to be a Jew is you ask questions. You get to be curious. It's not about the mystery. It's about your dad trying or your mom trying to answer a question, and you're allowed to be a curious child.
The curiosity is something we're trying to fill our children with, but there's something that underlies it, which is actually what I meant when I said, hey, why did you do that? Because you know what lies underneath curiosity? Wonder. if someone is trapped in a world in which they actually believe they understand and they more or less know what's coming next,
right,
and be it in a scientific worldview, in a narrative worldview, in their own educational process, then they may be able to generate a little bit of curiosity and may learn new things. But this is teaching us something fundamental, not only about what it is to learn, but what it is to be a Jew, which is that you have to engage the world with that openness to the fact that you don't know what will be. Because, of course, who was born in Nisan? Where do we get? I mean, you mentioned that great day for Abraham. And why is Abraham so connected to Nisan? His son Isaac. And Isaac's birth represents the fact that, what does it mean that a 99-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman who had been barren her whole life now have a baby boy? It means that the world is not at all what I thought it was.
Right. So Passover is coming, and with it, the preparation for Pesach, there's a general nervousness in the air, and it's very real. I have had the blessing of working in organizations that are manned and womaned by Orthodox Jews, and therefore, basically, the last week before Pesach, it's really a no-work week. You really can't work normally, and oftentimes, you know, I might not even have a show next week because we have so much to prepare for Pesach. We have so much to do, and I personally become under the auspices of my wife's. I'm under her command, as we say in Israel, taf pei, tachat pikud. I fall under her, like I become her employee, her...
servant.
Right, I become like her worker, and I basically clean, and she checks it, and it's a very funny relationship. And also, Jewish men, if you're married like I am to a Hungarian woman, you basically have to basically excuse your wife from too much nicitude in the next week. There's something that happens. Also, a genetic memory kicks in. There's a tension involved in getting rid of something. There's a expiation, a what's the English word, kirtsuf, so really like scrub it. There's like a scrubbing that happens, and in fact our great teacher the Ari HaKadosh, the Arizal, said that sweating in the preparation of the matzah it cleans you out like a burning fire, like a river of fire. It burns you out, especially from lasciviousness and those kind of sins.
Anything which heats the body.
That's right. It's a great expiation. And I'm very personally also excited about, also, you yourself are in the throes of preparation for matzah baking. I, too, am going to be baking matzah next week. For me, there's another personal thing, which is my great-grandparents in Poland were bread and matzah bakers.
Mm.
That was their profession. So when I show up at that fire... It's like again, a collective memory comes in, and it's like, and also, I this is something that I must tell every Jew who's listening, and also every non-Jew: find a Bible, a Jewish profession, a biblical profession. Learn to do something in Judaism, and not just be a bystander. Learn to read the Torah. Learn to stand up in front of a quorum and pray. Or learn to tie your tzitzit. Learn to do something physical in Judaism. You know, learn to build a mikvah. What else? Give me another example.
You can learn to write the letters of the tefillin and the mezuzah.
Something.
You can,
right?
Yeah. There's the many crafts in Torah, and I think you're absolutely right, because there's a power of action which transcends all the intellectual constructs and all the philosophy and even the emotional elements. There's something extremely visceral about action.
So, speaking of action, this week's Torah portion is Metzora, which is, again, what we talked about last week, the spiritual boo-boos, the blemishes that come from improper speech, and this week's Torah portion is going to focus in on that. And one of the most amazing parts of this Torah portion is that there is a disease, a spiritual blemish that's going to fall. Sure, you expect it on your body. That could happen. We're familiar with that. But it could also happen to your clothes. And even more weirdly, it could happen to your house. As you come into the land of Israel, if you don't behave nice, your house could get sick. And if your house gets sick, you've got to take it apart brick by brick, take out those bricks, and it's got to be kind of quarantined and studied by the priest, the Kohen. And it's kind of shameful because everybody sees you kind of being exiled from your own house.
All your stuff's out on the sidewalk.
Right, you're a bum. you're messed up. But we also learn an amazing thing, and the great commentator Rashi tells us, and the Talmud tells us, that there's a good reason for this expiation, this kind of embarrassment, and that is that the Canaanites, before they left the land of Israel, when they heard that the Jewish people were coming, they hid some of their treasures in the walls. So your wall may get sick, and you have to take apart the bricks of the house, and then lo and behold, there is treasure behind the bricks. And I think the deep meaning here is that sometimes bad things happen to us, but really it's actually hiding a treasure behind it. And we have when we deal with the boo-boo that happened to us, if we got delayed, we got stuck in traffic, we stubbed our toe, and of course harder things, oftentimes if you just take a deep breath, don't curse God, don't curse the table that stubbed your toe, don't curse yourself for being a clutch, just wait a second, you may see an amazing blessing hidden behind what seems to be a spiritual boo-boo.
I want to add an underlying message in what you said, is because it's, of course, as you pointed out, particularly in the illness of the house. And Rashi points out there that this is only true when we come into Israel. Like you said, the narrative explanation that the Canaanites hid their treasures there. But there's something fundamental about that, is that I think in order to discover the blessing that difficulties offer, and it's important to, I think, personally, to accept them as difficulties. Meaning, I find it very frustrating when people move immediately to, oh, this is for the good, and there's a blessing in here, without embracing the difficulty and the pain. There's nothing to be gained from running away from. It has to be a running into. So how do you cross that bridge? Well, it's specifically represented by the land of Israel. Because there's a permanence of residence, and therefore a commitment. You know, this house, if it were a tent in the wilderness, and you suddenly get this spiritual stain there, what are you going to do? You're going to pack it up and you go somewhere else. Here, when your house gets sick, when you're in the land of Israel, no, this is where I belong, this is where I am, and it's my commitment to being there that's going to cause me to dig underneath. And in that same sense, there's sort of a counter-teaching that you know that up until the time of the Chatam Sofer, the great leader of Hungarian and German Jewry in the beginning of the 19th century, he held that it was forbidden to build a house of stone outside of the land of Israel. Because it was too permanent.
Wow.
Because one had to understand.
I never heard that.
Yeah, one had to understand that our residence outside of the land of Israel is characterized by not only the willingness, but sometimes the eagerness to move on. Whereas what it means to live here in Israel, even if the house in which I live has this terrible stain and I have to get everything turned out on the street and it's embarrassing and difficult, okay, well, that's because ultimately my commitment to staying in that house is what's going to offer me the treasures that lie underneath.
So speaking of houses, we are right now at the Greg Cafe here at beautiful Mamilla Mall. I'm looking out the window. I see glorious clouds. And I see also, when I look behind me, I see the pedestrian walkway that is the Mamilla Mall. And I must say that it is gorgeous. It is full of life and full of people walking towards the old city or towards the center of town. Just fantastic. And it is important to remember that as we talked about earlier, only 20 years ago, this was a barren, no man's land. And today it is just one of the most bustling areas in Jerusalem. And that is literally rebirth. And one of the maitre d's, or whatever they're called here, at the cafe, just looked at me as you and I were talking words of Torah, and he gave me a big smile. And that big smile said to me, like, thank you for talking Torah here at Greg Cafe. In this reborn part of Jerusalem, not only is it reborn, but it's reborn and it's flowing with life. There's a river of life right below here. I also want to thank our good friend Jack for dedicating the show to his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah. God bless you guys, and keep it coming because you are helping this flow of Torah and of the rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel take place. I also want to thank the good folks at Capone Defense, who teach us how to fight, how to be fighters. Rabbi Mike, you teach us so much how to be a spiritual fighter, and we also have to marry that with being physical fighters, so that bad guys will never take advantage of us, so that we can have that spiritual renaissance in the land of Israel. So check out CaponeDefense.com. That's right, Capone, K-A-P-O-N, defense.com. I also want to thank the good people of Hebron for letting me do this show. That's my day job, which is to be the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron. I'm the consigliere for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At least I'd like to think of myself as that. So come visit Hebron, and let me know. If you're interested in visiting Hebron, write me an email to yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And thelandofisrael.com is an incredible premier network of amazing content from the land of Israel. And I want you to check out more of Rabbi Mike's and Sulam Yaakov's amazing Torah, and that's found at sulamyaakov.com. So check it out. You will be filled with continuing Torah education, and there's so much to prepare for this Passover, Pesach. Let us seal the deal on today's show by talking about the Sabbath. This Shabbat is Shabbat HaGadol. We have a few Shabbats that have a name, and this one is called the Big Sabbath. The big one. Right, the Big Sabbath. And this is the Sabbath that prepares us for Passover, for the kind of it's like you know that we're going to be born. You know that the birth is going to happen at a certain time, and so this is the preparation. And one of the things that marks the Big Sabbath, the Shabbat HaGadol, is that we usually we have a custom to read the whole Haggadah. The text of Passover, and also we usually hear a rabbi's speech. That's just one of the main customs. You kind of have to hear the Drashat Shabbat HaGadol. That's like one of the things that you got to do on this Shabbat. So what's Shabbat HaGadol all about?
Well, you know, the Sorim Kedoshim, you know, the Trishan teaches us that before any Chag, before any festival, the light of that festival appears in the world in the preceding Shabbat, which means that the light of freedom and emunah, the deep faithfulness to God and the Torah and our history, will already be pouring into the world come this Shabbat. And this is one of the reasons that we read the Haggadah, that we go hear the drasha, that we try to build kelim, we try to build vessels to receive that light already. And if you think, historically speaking, it marks the time when the one action which the Jewish people did, which Am Yisrael did in the process of the Exodus, was done on this day. What was it? When we were going to make the Passover offering, Moshe came to us early at the instructions of God and said, listen, I want you to take a goat in front of all the Egyptians, because, of course, the Egyptians worshipped it as their god, tie it to a bedpost for 4 days so that every Egyptian that sees it says, hey, man, what's with the goat tied to your bedpost? And the answer is, oh, when we're ready, when our God says so, we're going to slaughter your god. We're going to eat it whole. And we're going to walk on out of here, right? And that power of, I mean, the absurdity of these slave people who've been enslaved for hundreds of years, looking at their masters while they're still enslaved, they're still in Egypt, and saying, it's over already. Your culture's dead man walking. We are already on the train to the future, right? And that power of unbounded faith, that knowing that even though what you see is not yet expressive of the reality, it's simply not yet in the sense of od ma'at yavo. It's just a little bit more and it'll come.
And there's also the element of defiance, which is to defy the world, to defy the expectations, to defy fear, to defy fear, and to defy fear. And to
not let it define.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why I really like the Shabbat. It's a little bit of defiance. And all of us have to defy a little bit of our own expectations, as we said, about ourselves. We have to defy ourselves a little bit. We have to defy our the self-imposed limitations. And they may be even deeply held beliefs. By the way, that's one of the greatest things about joining the IDF, is that you learn that a lot of times your own self-imposed definitions of your own limitations are just that.
Yes.
And that you're able to much, much more than you think.
For a decade, I was a guide and an instructor in the outdoors, climbing, boating, hiking, and the primary principle of outdoor education, which I was taught, which I employed, which is, I believe you can do more than you believe you can. Right. You never say it to someone, because that's demeaning. But you simply hold that posture. I've pushed more people up and over mountains, made them do things that they swore and cried and puked that they couldn't do. And at the end of it, looked at them and said, see?
Well,
and you could do it.
I think we should all swear, cry, and puke that we're going to Exodus, Egypt.
We're getting out, man.
We're getting out, and we're also getting out of our own personal Egypts and the Egypts that others want to impose on us. Certainly today, as the Jewish people are exploding forth, there are efforts to hem us in, to box us in, to keep us in a tight little noose. so that we don't get out of hand, so it doesn't explode too much, so that we don't make anybody look smaller, or whatever other reasons they want, or maybe because they don't want our God to shine. But it's not gonna, nothing's going to stop us now.
All it is Mitzarim, right? In Hebrew, Egypt is Mitzrayim, which means Mitzarim means a narrow place. You ever doing any boating? You ever been on a canoe and, or a kayak in white water? What happens when the river gets narrow?
The water goes fast.
Oh, yeah. It picks up momentum.
Right.
All that effort to close us down and box us in right now is simply serving the purpose of gathering our momentum and energy so that when we shoot out into the freedom that lies ahead of us, we will be like a rocket in the night.
Amazing. Great mashal, great paradigm. Great
metaphor.
Metaphor. I appreciate it very much. And I want to thank you very much, Rabbi Mike Foyer. I want to wish you success in making your awesome matzah this year and having that that bursting forth. And all of you out there as well, write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. If you have any questions or thoughts for Rabbi Mike, and people have had that recently, I've been forwarding him emails. So please do so. Write me an email. Don't get lazy. Connect on Twitter. Connect on Facebook. Connect on YouTube. Connect on LinkedIn. Connect any way you want. More than anything, look back into the Torah, into the Bible. Connect with the God of Israel. Connect with the fulfillment of prophecy, which is the return of the Jewish people's return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel by being part of the story. Rabbi Mike, have a great Pesach, and thank you so much for being with us.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach and Shalom. All right, folks, I hope you've enjoyed Spiritual Cafe, and before that, Myrna Strap with the story of John Henry Patterson, Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson. It's been a great show, very inspiring. Things that can happen in a cafe, right? And they get broadcast to the whole world. What an honor and a pleasure it is to be with you wherever you are, jogging, walking your dog, washing dishes, or sitting in traffic somewhere in Atlanta, Georgia. Wherever you are, it's just an honor to be with you. Write me an email. Let me know where you are. My email address is Yishai, Y-I-S-H-A-I, @thelandofisrael.com. And indeed, you're listening to thelandofisrael.com. Also, check out the place that I'm so honored and proud to work for, and that is Hebron, the Jewish community of and international heritage site, the founders of monotheistic civilization, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Check it out at Hebron.com. Wherever you are, folks, stay part of the story. Social media, I'm out there for you, both on Twitter and on Facebook and on LinkedIn and on YouTube. All that is there for you. But of course, connect to the God of Israel, to the story of Israel, to the light of Israel, which is shining forth from the land of Israel here at thelandofisrael.com. Stay tuned, folks. More great stuff is on the way. God bless you and Shalom.